You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Will Parsonson, tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 18th of April. My name is Will Parsonson, filling in for Lillian Hanley today as she is away. I'm joined in studio by Lisa and Ellen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So, how are we doing?
Do you expect something a bit more like...
Yeah. Extravagant, yeah. Sorry. Ellen is here for Dear Science, as per usual, which is first up. If I ake nei, coming up on The Wire today, we've got Dear Science with AT's Ellen Blackman. We're talking Nazi warships and eating plastic, I wrote, but we'll get into that more. And Einstein. Tracy Martin talks to Lillian Hanley about oil drilling and teacher titles. Producer Lisa Baudet talks to Liv Young, the creator of Mental, an online platform for sharing personal stories on mental health. And for our last story, we're talking about Campylobacter, which is a bit of a hot talking point at the moment, about chicken and getting sick from chicken, which you shouldn't do. It's not a good idea. To get in touch, tuku paitui mai, wai mai ranei, text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309-3879. And now it's time for...
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Hello, Ellen.
Afternoon, Will.
How are you going?
I'm marking first year exams, so, you know, not brilliant.
So great. You're doing fantastic. The weather's brilliant. There's no wind.
If there's any of those students listening to this, by crikey, I'll have words to you when semester starts again.
Well,
is it really that bad?
Hey, let's not dwell on that. It's our reunion, Ellen. I haven't been on the show in for a very long time.
Indeed, yes.
I've been missing Dear Science.
Yes, well, we've been missing you, Will.
So Ellen's been missing someone that knows a little bit about science, I think.
Hey, that's not, you guys
that
know
is
stuff.
Not true. That is
big
not true.
Speaking of science, that is what the show's about.
Indeed.
First up, we've got a story, like I said, about Nazi warships, but then... Norway, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And how they used chemical gas smoke screens and how that's affected trees.
Yeah, no, this is a really nice little story, one I knew absolutely nothing about, and it's just come out very, very recently. So your listeners may have heard of the Tirpitz, maybe, possibly.
I haven't.
Maybe. No? Okay.
Enlighten me.
But you've heard of the Bismarck, maybe?
Yes.
Okay, so the Bismarck and the Tirpitz were sister ships, so okay. They were sort of built... same design and everything. And the Tirpitz was a bit bigger, and it was built in 1941, and the Germans were going to use this to sort of wreak havoc on the Allied convoys running from Britain to the States, and from Britain also to Soviet Union up in Murmansk, up above the Arctic Circle. And so they wanted to get rid of the ship, obviously, and the Germans didn't want them to get rid of the ship. So the Germans would, they based the Tirpitz in Norway, and there's plenty of fjords in Norway to hide a big old battleship and stuff. And so I guess the Allies were never quite sure where it was. Came out occasionally, lobbed a few shells, and then went back into hiding and stuff. And in terms of hiding itself, they would do a few things. One thing was to cut down a whole lot of trees and sort of cover the ship in trees. So,
oh,
which
it's pretty pragmatic. I like this.
Which hides it from, I guess, aerial reconnaissance. And the other way was to use, and I never knew this, was a chemical fog.
Yeah, because when I read this, it said chemical fog.
Yes, indeed.
Which, I mean, at the beginning, I was sort of like, oh, you can use, well, I mean... I grew up playing video games and stuff, and, you know, there's smoke bombs and it hides the people or whatever, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's actually a damaging chemical.
Oh, my goodness, is it what? Yes, and I'm amazed that they use this, but the chemical they use is a thing called chlorosulfuric acid.
Sounds okay. Great.
Well, it's even stronger than sulfuric acid. So if you've ever had anything to do with sulfuric acid, chlorosulfuric acid is a sort of a league apart in this. And what they do would be to mix this with water, and you get this very, very vigorous reaction which ensues, and you get this sort of vapor or cloud of a mixture of hydrochloric acid and sulfuric acid in the air. And this creates a fog, which apparently hides the ship, and again, you know, from prying eyes. Now, a mixture of hydrochloric acid and sulfuric acid, you can well imagine, isn't going to be the best for the environment. And
well, I mean, first of all, not great for the environment.
No.
Second of all, ships involve people to drive them.
That's what amazes me, that they would use this around the sailors, because, you know, you go inhaling this stuff. It's Yeah, it's a nasty mixture. So what the hell they were thinking using this, I don't know. But so the, you know, this is the ultimate NASA rain, really. You know, this is this really is. But very, very recently, so there was a German scientist who was sort of looking around the fjords, and she was interested in counting rings and trees and stuff like that. And so she got to this fjord where the turbots had been, and started looking at a few trees there and the growth rings on the trees. And she found around the year 1945 that the growth of some trees actually stopped and didn't resume again for another sort of 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
That long?
So, yeah.
Far out.
Hmm. So the turbots was sunk in 1944. Hmm. And so obviously they were doing all of this sort of stuff around that time. And she really couldn't get her head around why these trees should be so stunted, but then apparently a colleague suggested to her, oh, you know, the turbots was around there then, and so a little bit of digging and stuff, and they found that, yeah, this is what they used for their chemical fog. And so obviously it really ripped the shit out of these trees, and there were some trees there that sort of took about 30 odd years to get back to normal growth.
Wow.
Far out.
Yeah. So what they conjecture happened was that the needles on the trees, they're pine trees, so the needles were destroyed. And obviously if the tree doesn't have any needles, then it can't photosynthesize, and so it can't generate biomass, and so it can't grow. So
and how do they tell how, I mean, there's the thing about the rings on trees.
And that's how they were going. So there were actually no rings for 1945.
But how do they know there were no rings for that time?
Because they can date the tree back you know, from the present day. So you just count the number of rings from the present day and go backwards. And then they would find that, oh, you know, here's something obviously very, very wrong about this time, about 1945. And
would you see any noticeable differences in the way the rings form? Would they be closer or further apart?
Apparently closer, and to some extent it's just non-existent. And what they also found was that there was a distance dependence. So the place where the turbots was, they'd go 1K, 2K, 3K, 4K away. And by the time they got 4K away, they would find that there was no change to all the trees. So, so that, you know, that's a big distance for the stuff to travel and sort of impede the growth of the trees. So it's a remarkable little story, this. And
it shows us the dangers of chemicals, like we say recently with the chemical weapons attack in Syria and things like that.
Yes, indeed.
Shows us how intense this sort of stuff can be.
Not to give chemicals a bad name, though, Will. You know.
No.
No, not chemicals in general.
I would never talk down to your love.
So, yeah, I thought that was a nice little, well, not necessarily a nice little story, but a very interesting little story, I'd say.
It's one of those stories that you'd bring up at a bar and go, I know this. And people go, how do you know that? Talk to Alan.
Well, I mean, you'd have to remember the name of the guest, really. I don't know. Can you remember it?
The next story. The next story is about, like I said before, eating plastic, but not humans eating plastic, because that would be... not the best.
Wouldn't be probably the best, but again, a very interesting story that just came out in the last couple of days. And so this all started about a couple of years ago, 2016, where they were looking at a Japanese plastic recycling plant where they were recycling all these plastic bottles made of polyethylene terephthalate, or PET. And they found a bacterium there that was apparently living off the plastic. And that, oh, goodness me, that's interesting. And so, you know, if anybody doesn't believe in evolution, you know, these bacteria evolved to live on plastic, you know, because, you know, plastic's only been around for sort of 100 years or so. And that's a very sort of quick evolution, apparently, you know, very, very, very rapid. Anyway, they're obviously interested in how the bacteria were doing this. And the way to figure that out generally is to... try and look at the structure of the molecules in the bacterium. So it's an enzyme in the bacterium. So an enzyme is just a gigantic molecule, basically. Huge. Essentially made up of a whole lot of amino acids, and it's folded in a particular way, and blah, 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 blah. So you need to know how it's folded. You need to know its three-dimensional structure before you can sort of figure out how it's doing what it's doing. And so what they did to do this was they got what's called an X-ray structure of the enzyme. And... so the Japanese workers isolated the stuff. These workers in now England and the States have been working on getting the X-ray structure of this thing, which tells you down to atomic detail. You can see the individual atoms in detail, what's bonded to each other, the overall shape of it, and from that you can sort of conjecture how it might be going about chewing up these this plastic. And so they have done this, and they used a very, very, very bright X-ray source that they've got over in England. And they sort of thought, oh, that looks kind of like something we've seen before. And there are bacteria that can chew up the surfaces of plants. So the surface of some plants got a waxy thing called cutin on it, which is a polymer. It's a polyester. Now, polyethylene terephthalate just happens to be a polyester as well. It's a polymer. A whole lot of individual monomers joined together to make this polymer. And they thought, oh, okay, so this looks kind of similar. Maybe we could sort of tweak this around and see what happens. So they tweaked it around, added a few amino acids here and there, and they found that they got an even better enzyme to chew up the plastic. So it works even better with a little bit of human help. So now the really good thing about this, okay, so we talk about plastic recycling and stuff, recycling plastics, which is all well and good. And that's a, let's say, a physical recycling. So you start off with your plastic bottles and stuff. You know, you finish whatever's in them, put them in the recycling plant. What do? They basically shred them, and it'll end up in fleeces or clothing or something like that as Dacron, or it'll end up in carpets, you know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
But you get an unavoidable degradation of the material, okay? So you go from high-quality, transparent plastic to, you know, stuff that you're going to use in carpets, and eventually that wears out, and eventually things are going to end up in the landfill anyway.
Yep.
You know, we might think we're doing good here, but we're really only delaying the inevitable in terms of putting things in a landfill. So the beauty of this is that this enzyme that they have made now, I guess, takes the polymer and chews it up to its individual monomers, okay? Now, so we need a little bit of chemistry here.
Yes.
So to make a polymer, we need, in this case, two starting materials, this thing called terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol. You might have heard of the latter one, that's sort of antifreeze glycol, okay?
Okay.
And you mix them together and you get this chemical reaction called a polymerization. And you start off with essentially a couple of liquids and you get this big polymer, okay, which is made up of literally millions and millions and millions of these units. Now, what this enzyme does is it chops all the bonds between those millions and millions of units, so you end up with your starting materials again.
Okay.
And so you end up with your starting material, and then you can make the plastic all over again.
So it's the ultimate recycling.
This is chemical, this is what I call, anyway, chemical recycling. This is true recycling, okay? So you're actually making something and then breaking it down to its component parts and then remaking it and breaking it down, et cetera, et cetera.
So you could not ever really have to make new plastic.
There we go. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just reuse continuously the same things.
Yep.
How would this work on a massive scale, though?
See, there's always a naysayer.
It's me. I'm him.
And I agree with you, Will. Okay, so the important point is that these guys have got their patent. So, you know, they've demonstrated proof of principle and everything. So that's the number one important thing. Now, we're talking sort of 50-odd million tonnes of PET per year. And that's around about 1/6 of the world's production of plastics every year. So this enzyme is only specific for this one particular plastic. Now, granted, you know, it makes up a fair old whack of all the plastics. But you're going to need truckloads of this particular bacterium to be able to do these things at anything approaching a rate that's going to be commercially viable. And the other thing is that all of your components for plastics at the moment come from oil. And they're all cheap, all your starting materials for, you know. Now, again, oil's going to run out at some stage, so we're going to have to look for other sources of these components of plastics. But at the moment, is it going to be commercially viable? The answer's probably not at the moment. But, you know, somewhere down the track, who knows? But there's a hell of a lot of work that's got to be done between now and then in order to get this on some sort of footing where, you know, some day down the line, they'll be able to use this in a meaningful fashion.
It's good to know that something's changing, though, and that we're actually...
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. You know, this is really, really important stuff. I mean, as I always say, we live in the age of plastic, like it or not. You know, plastic... Try and imagine a world without plastic. Just, you know, everybody, look around
everywhere.
You. Plastic is utterly, utterly ubiquitous, and whether we like it or not, we're stuck with it. It has improved our lives enormously in some respects. The obvious downside of it is the plastic waste. And you know, I went to the Mediterranean last year, and seeing all the plastic coming up on the beaches and everything, it was just a real eye-opener. You know, you never see that in New Zealand, God no. But you know, it's just appalling.
So this is just sort of having a pragmatic position on the matter and thinking plastic's always going to be there, or at least for a foreseeable future.
Absolutely.
And so trying to find a solution based on that instead of trying to eradicate it.
Yep. And then other people are trying to create biodegradable plastics.
That's
another way that you can do it. You can actually make the plastic, which after a given length of time will biodegrade. If you go and put it on landfill, it'll get chewed up or whatever. It's got these bonds that can be chewed up. So that's another way of doing things as well. So people are looking at the problem. They realise what the problem is. They're looking at it, and this is another approach to the problem. A really, really, really nice one. We'll see how it goes in the future, I guess.
I mean, humanity moves so fast. We'll make progress where we can, I guess.
Yes.
But speaking of, he's thinking of the transition. We're talking just to finish off. We're talking about Einstein's birthday, which is
no, it's not his birthday.
Oh, what is
no,
it?
It's the
it's
opposite.
Death.
Oh, his death
yes.
day. Happy yes. death day,
I know,
Einstein.
I know. So 1955. This day in 1955.
Quick presentation.
A quick presentation. Well, you can't say enough about Einstein because he was a genius in the true sense of the word. It's an off-bandied around term, but this guy was just miles ahead of anybody else scientifically in the last century. He was Time's person of the century for the 1900 to 2000. So, which I didn't know until and fully deserving as well. His ideas have changed the world, and he explained so many things, and most people would be really, really grateful for just one, great invention or whatever, or great discovery or great thought during their lives. And Einstein had so many, it's ridiculous. You ask anybody on the street, probably, just walking down the street, what's a scientific equation that you know?
Oh, don't ask me that.
Oh, come on.
I really don't know anything.
E equals MC squared. There you go, Alan.
There we go. But E equals MC squared. If people know one scientific equation, that's the one that they're going to know. And this simple equation just boggles the mind because it equates energy and matter. And it says that matter is energy and energy is matter. And they're related by this thing, the speed of light squared, which is a huge number, which means that a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of matter contains an enormous, unbelievable amount of energy. And that's the way that the sun operates on this thing called nuclear fusion. And essentially, you're turning matter into energy.
Mm.
And again, that's what happens when, in atomic bombs and nuclear bombs and stuff. You're doing that same sort of thing. So there's the theory of relativity. And the thing about Einstein, you think he's a scientist. So you think, white coat in the lab, blah, 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 blah. Not a bit of it. He was not an experimentalist. He did all of his experiments in his head. Or certainly very, very many of them anyway. And he did what the Germans call Gedankenexperimente, or Experimenten, possibly, which are thought experiments.
Mm.
And so the way he got the theory of relativity, he imagined himself sitting on a beam of light. And what would he see if he was sitting on a beam of light? And from what, and then he said, if I was travelling alongside another beam of light, that other beam of light would appear to me to be stationary. And that can't be, because we know that the speed of light is constant. That's a really weird thing. The speed of light is constant regardless of whether you're travelling towards the source or moving away from the source or whatever. It's a constant everywhere. And so he sort of thought, here's a problem here. And so he went on to get the special theory of relativity and the general theory of relativity just from doing these thought experiments. And utterly incredible intellect. And somebody who has advanced humanity and humanity's understanding of the universe, and just a great, 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 great person. So, the world's a poorer place for his departing. So 1955, it's a long time ago.
Yeah. That's a long time ago.
Yeah. That's older even than me.
We'll have to finish it up there. But happy death day, Einstein.
Yeah, I know.
Is that a thing that you say, though?
It is now.
Never heard it before.
Probably not really. But, if you don't know anything about Einstein, go and Google him and just see, the amazing things he did, because he was quite an amazing
man. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we'll be back after these breaks.
Okay.
Do us all a favour, here, wear this polythene back.
Plus One, 95 BFM and Under the Radar present John Cooper Clarke with two Auckland shows. The iconic poet, punk and snazzy dresser is headed to New Zealand doing classic spoken word and extraordinary new material. John Cooper Clarke, April 21st at the Crystal Palace, and the sold-out April 22nd show at the Vic Devonport. Don't miss out. Tickets from undertheradar.co.nz.
That's about the speed I do it.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
We're having a few issues with playing this interview, but we will go on to Lisa's interview next. We'll play Tracy Martin after her interview.
In 2013, one in six New Zealanders had been diagnosed with a common mental disorder at some point in their lives. That was 5 years ago, and as attitude slowly shifts from stigma to assistance, there are reasons to believe more people are in fact affected by some sort of mental health issue in the course of their existence. Liv Young has decided to offer them a platform. She created a website called Mental, where individuals can share their story without judgment. I spoke with Liv and asked her to explain how she came up with the idea of this medium.
Mental is an online platform for sharing the experiences of those who are affected by mental health. It's an inclusive platform. It's a website where people can share their submissions, either anonymous or otherwise, on what mental health means to them. I decided to launch Mental about a year ago. A really good friend of mine experiences bipolar episodes, and between the two of us, we realised there was a gap in New Zealand storytelling with regards to what mental health is and what it means to individuals. So I wanted to create something that was free of judgment, perception, attitude for those who actually can speak at it firsthand from a very personal and subjective place.
I had a look at the website. The layout is very simple and it's pretty straightforward as well. There's, you know, you've got the homepage, there's a few line per stories, and then if you click on each story, you have access to the full story. That's about all it is. There's no information side, no phone numbers or whatever kind of information you could have on mental health in general. Why did you choose to have this platform just for storytelling?
I chose to have a platform just for storytelling to give those who have the stories to tell the full power and the full control. I think there are a lot of conversations out there around what mental health is, coming from the medical sector, more specifically mental health sector and system, and from individuals using platforms like social media, and also the general media as well are all talking about mental health at the moment. It's on the agenda as well in Parliament. But I think when you strip it all back, it's really important to hear from those who can speak firsthand about mental health, which is why the site ourmentalstory.com is so simple and so clear.
What can people gain from reading stories that others have written where they share their experience?
I think the power of digital storytelling is really strong. It's beneficial for those who are writing those stories, and I think it's beneficial for those who are reading those stories. They might resonate with those stories on a personal level, or it might enable them to understand and empathise with those in their community, in their workplace, at home, or friends who are experiencing some form of mental health. And they can go, hey, okay, cool, I can't relate to that personally, but now I might be able to communicate with that person better. I might be able to understand what they are thinking and what they are going through, and provide them with some level of support and care.
It seems the purpose is sort of like to show people that they're not alone, that others have gone through similar experience, are going through similar experience at the same time, that there's a sense of community that you're trying to create?
Mental is trying to create a sense of community. Something I've realised over the last year or so is that people do feel pretty isolated. People are seeking real connections and real conversations. And I'm hoping through our mentalstory.com that we can provide a platform for people to get a sense of togetherness, a sense of, hey, I'm not alone. I can relate to these people's stories and I have a place here. I am valued and I am worthy of sharing my story.
You're not trying to become a platform for advice or for guidance. It's not really the main goal.
I think the power of storytelling can certainly offer a layer or level of advice to individuals. But again, it comes from a very personal, subjective place. It might not be a medical professional that is offering that advice and that care, but I do think that individuals who understand mental health do have great advice to give to others.
Mm. I was wondering, are the stories moderated or curated at all? Do you pick them? Do you edit them? Is there anything that is being done to the stories?
There is a small amount of sub-editing that does occur before we publish the stories. It is kept to a minimum to ensure that the voices of the individuals are authentic and true to their own stories.
Mm. But anyone can supply with the confidence that their story is going to be shared?
The majority of the stories that are submitted that fit within the mental health realm are published, yes.
So what would you say belongs in this category? I feel like one of the things that's happening at the moment is that maybe there's a tendency to sort of like widen the spectrum of what sort of fits into mental health issues. I read a few of the stories, and there's anorexia, there's bipolarity, there's borderline, you know, psychosis or schizophrenia. What qualifies as mental health issues now?
I think that the individual people that are writing in can define what mental health is. Just as broad as physical health is, I think mental health is also as broad. It relates to anything of the mind, anything that relates to the mental state of mm-hmm. of a human or a human experience. I'm really hoping that mental can provide a safe and inclusive space for people that is free of labels. I think that there is certainly an attitude out there around the world that you need to have a label, you need to be diagnosed in order to have some mental health illness. Mm. On a personal level, I don't believe that is the case. I believe that mental health affects everyone. Therefore, everyone is welcome to share their experience on their own personal journey of mental health.
Would you agree that there's a big stigma around mental health still in New Zealand? I don't come from New Zealand. I come from France. And when I first got here, I realised that there was a huge taboo on, well, suicide predominantly, but I guess mental health in general. And I have seen evolution and I have seen progress in the way it's been handled, I guess, but there is still, I feel, a very big stigma around having issues, mental health issues. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that there is a certain attitude towards those who say, hey, I'm struggling with my mental health. I think we have a long way to go in New Zealand, but I have seen huge progress in the last 10 years. First, experienced anxiety when I was about 16 years of age, and I didn't even know really what anxiety meant at the time. Hmm. And at the time, I didn't have a lot of people to chat about in my kind of community with my friends and peers at school. And that's changed. And I think a lot of that is driven by fear. I think a lot of people fear being judged, fear being isolated even further, or fear being excluded by their peers and colleagues and family members, when really all they need is someone to say, "Hey, I'm here for you. I hear you, and I care for you," and maybe give them a bit of love. Anyone has that ability to do that, to help an individual who's having a tough time.
But you also said that Mantle was sort of like here to fill a void, I guess a void that has been left there by certain institutions. Even though there is progress, there is still maybe a little bit of room for improvement. So what would you say hasn't been done the right way? What is missing? What's not enough in the way institutions in New Zealand handle mental health?
There's a lot of media out there at the moment around the weaknesses in the mental health system. So people who need assistance from the medical sector to best support their mental health. I think there are people who are falling through the cracks that have not found the resources and the tools to get the help that they need. I think that's an area that we as New Zealanders need to work on. And in part, I think that comes down to everyone. It's not just about the medical sector providing the services that people need, but it is about, on a day-to-day level, checking in with people that you know and seeing how they are and seeing whether they need some support. And that can occur on a very simple level.
So the gap that you're trying to fill is the one where we sort of like break down the stigma, and we have people telling their stories, and we make it more out there, I guess, and more open. And in doing this, we are sort of getting rid of the stigma.
I am hoping that Mental will be a platform that is open and honest and truthful and safe, and that it does break down those attitudes that may exist in New Zealand around what mental health is.
What does the future hold for Mental? Are you going to keep going in this direction? Is there anything else that you have planned?
I hope that people continue to share their stories through Mental, mm-hmm. and we will continue to publish them. At the moment, that's the great plan with Mental, and I'm really very happy to receive anyone's stories that they may share with us.
For anyone who wants to submit a story to Mental, how can they do that?
You can head to ourmentalstory.com, and on there is a share your story button, and you can click on that and write your name, or you can choose to be anonymous. Either is absolutely fine, and write a story and submit it through to us.
The Wire. Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just...
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
This morning, Lillian Hanley spoke with Tracy Martin about oil drilling and Tracy's old members' bill to ensure correct titling of the teacher profession.
From Wellington, Whiteplain, plane. Unbelievably lovely place. I highly recommend it.
15 minutes?
Yeah. Well, it is a small plane, so it was a particularly bumpy ride yesterday, which was a bit, your heart's in your mouth a little bit, but... But no, 15 minutes by plane. It was awesome.
And you said the city was really beautiful.
Yeah, whether you'd call it a city, maybe technically it is a city, but it looks like a town, So it's got a great heritage-looking courthouse, but it's got a lot of modern facilities. It's incredibly clean and tidy. So, no, I love it. Looks neat. I'm going to have to come back for a visit.
Awesome. All right, well, I guess the first news of the week is the oil and gas exploration permits being banned. Do you have anything to say about that in terms... I know you're not regional development minister, but New Zealand First has said that they will fight for the regions.
Well, and we did. And so what we did was, they haven't been banned. What they've done is there'll be no more block office. So what that means is that we're not going to be giving out any more opportunities to get any more exploration licenses, right? So that's the first thing. So it's about exploration licenses. The ones there are currently, I can't remember how many exploration licenses there are right now,
but they are in play. So they haven't been banned, they haven't been cancelled, they are in play, and they can still use them. And then if, when those people who have the exploration licences, if they find something, they still have the opportunity to apply for a drilling licence. So that hasn't gone away either. What it says is that this government is signalling that we have to move to an economy that is not based upon, drill it, pump it out, and away we go. We have to shift. Everybody knows we have to shift with regard to our climate change commitments, or just for the planet generally. So this is a signal that we're going to shift.
So it is more symbolic than it is practically physical at this moment.
It's an indication that we're not going to allow anybody else to go out and try and look for more fossil fuels or to see if we can, dig anything else out of the ground. It's certainly, and New Zealand First made sure of it, because, this is a transition economy that we're in. And it takes about between 20 and 30 years to get something online anyway, if you're talking about, offshore gas or something like that. So we wanted to make sure that, one, people know we're changing, there's not going to be any more, but we certainly didn't want to destroy communities and give them a major shock. So this is a long lead-in period to a transition economy.
The other thing that's been happening in your world is the teacher title bill. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bill that was actually put on the ballot in my name. And so once you become a minister, you're not allowed a member's bill. So Jenny Marcroft very kindly took over that bill for me. I sort of explained it in my video blog, where it came from. What we have seen over the last 9 years particularly is we've seen a government that said in early childhood teaching that actually we don't need trained and qualified early childhood teachers, so you don't have to have them all inside your early childhood education facility. We've seen a government that said they opened up a series of schools and said, well, actually, you don't need to have a trained and qualified teacher standing in your classroom, so we're going to give you the ability to opt out of that. We've seen a government that has, through Teach First NZ, allowed graduates, after a six-week Christmas course, to be teaching apprentices in the classroom. Now, people might all be fine with that, but my point and the point of my bill is the fact that they are not trained and qualified teachers, and I believe, as a parent, I would like to know if the person standing in front of my child or talking or marketing themselves as a trained and qualified professional is exactly that. That was the point of the bill.
Is this about demarcating between institutions?
No, it's about recognising that trained and qualified teachers have done years of training, particularly ECE and primary school teachers, have done years of training to understand how learning happens. Now, everybody seems to be focusing on, well, if I know how to do something and I show you how to do it, then I'm teaching you, right? But the trained and qualified teachers in ECE and primary school, they've had to do their whole first year on how does oral language happen? Because oral language, and how does that connect to the written word? And what do you do if there's some neurodiversity? And what do you do if actually you've got this child challenged by this? They have to understand the process of learning. That is completely different than me just showing you how to do something. So what I was seeking to do, and maybe it's the wrong method, I'm open to that, that's fine. We've had a very interesting conversation take place since that bill got pulled from the ballot. But what I was trying to do was get the recognition for early childhood teachers and primary school teachers particularly that they deserve. They've studied, they know they are highly qualified professionals, and their title should be able to give them that status.
It is absolutely a profession, I agree, and it needs to be validated. I think some of the criticisms are more about, I saw Nikki Kaye wondering whether dance teachers and so on would then be removed as being called teachers.
Well, I think it's very interesting because dance teachers and that at the moment aren't covered by the Education Act 1989, and that bill, I believe, this is my understanding, I hadn't... it changes the Education Act 1989. So I'm actually going to go and seek some advice about whether what the National Party is putting out is even within scope of the bill. because what my bill does, or what Jenny's bill does now, is just change the Education Act 1989. So I'll go and find that out now, because I'm not confident that what they're saying is actually the reality. However, if you are a dance instructor, do you see that as somebody who is different from a dance teacher? And if you do, what difference does that interchange of words mean to you?
Fair enough.
See what I mean?
Well, I guess it becomes, when you're talking teaching and teaching as a profession, that also includes, like you say, learning how children learn. And it isn't simply instructing a certain skill, which can be done in any area or institution. That's
exactly
what you mean.
You know, because we've had parents as first teachers, for example, has been a thing, right? And that's when parents actually, through Play Centre, you learn certain skills and so on, and you actually say, well, okay, you when you're putting out your washing, you say to the children, you go and get me 3 yellow pegs. You're actually just taught 3 things. You've taught yellow, you've taught 3, and you've taught pegs.
And what pegs are for?
Yeah, right, okay, 4 things. But I guess what I was, you know, what I was trying to do was actually to give those people who had studied the fact that they understood that that was exactly what you had done. I was trying to give them the status that I believe they deserve, and that's been sort of whittled away over the last 9 years. But having said that, listen, it was an idea, and that's what members' bills are for. They're to put out an idea, to try and address something that you think needs to be addressed. And then we have a conversation about it, and it may be that it's not the right way to do it. That's okay too. I do find the viciousness with which some people have attacked Jenny Marcroft over being the, you know, having her name on this bill, I find that very, very interesting. And considering we've got, you know, Anti-Bullying Week coming up in May, I think there's a, you know, this country needs to have a really strong look at how we decide to criticise people.
Maybe that should be a new members' bill. No, but I think you're right. In terms of validating teachers or validating a certain skill or profession is really important. Yeah, my question would be around, does this mean that it invalidates other teaching or other learning, whether that be outside of the profession?
Well, I thought it was, yeah, I think that's really interesting, because when you're at, when people at university, are they lecturers, are they?
Yep.
Right. So are they invalidated if this changes? Because they don't call themselves teachers. They deliberately call themselves lecturers because they see that as having a different status. If you think about those with a PhD, they call themselves doctor because they see that as having a different status. I'm really interested that a whole lot of people don't want this particular profession to be able to have this status, that they all want to use it. I think that's been very, very interesting.
Does this mean teachers will get a pay rise?
They're not. The two things are not connected.
Okay.
But nice segue.
All right. All right, we can leave it there. We can talk about pay rises another time.
Okay,
have a good day, Tracy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you later.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
I've been around the world and I've met many people, kings and queens. But I've never met a better man than my friend Eric Clapton.
From Oscar award-winning Lily Finney Zanuck comes an unflinching and deeply personal look into the life of one of the greatest guitarists of our time.
I was in absolute denial about my alcoholism. Music saved me.
Eric Clapton, Life in 12 Bars. Out now on DVD and digital thanks to Madman Entertainment.
Australia's finest thrash party duo are hitting the road with their new album Bloody Lovely, setting stages alight and celebrating a decade of debauchery. If you want to get sweaty at Galatos with DZ Death Rays, then stay tuned to 95BFM all this week for a chance to win tickets. Ace. Banished Music in association with 95BFM presents DZ Death Rays with very special guest Wax Chattels, April 26th at Galatos. Tickets from under the radar.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
You've probably noticed a few weird things happening in this show, and I'll tell you now, we've just had a few issues with the board with all the buttons and the switches and things. It's all very radio-esque and things like that. But I'm a bit new to this, and it's a bit hard, and no one knows what's going on in the station, so apologies for that. So, on to our next story, with no faults whatsoever, he says, hopefully. You might have heard that this morning, it's been all over the news. A University of Otago study has found out that very few people actually know that most chicken in New Zealand is contaminated by Campylobacter. BFM producer Ben Weber talked to one of the authors of the study, Otago University infectious disease researcher Professor Michael Baker, about the bacteria, how to handle poultry, and how not to get infected.
Campylobacteriosis is quite a long term, but that's just to say, it's just to describe a bacterial infection with Campylobacter. And the reason people are concerned about this disease is it's the commonest notifiable disease in New Zealand, so it's a major cause of serious gastroenteritis. That's typically where you get diarrhea, in this case a little bit of maybe nausea and vomiting, but people do describe severe stomach cramps and basically feeling very unwell, typically for 5 days or sometimes longer.
So why is it that New Zealand has one of the highest rates of this in the world?
Well, it's still a bit of a mystery, but we are assuming that it's because there's higher levels of exposure to the bacteria in this country. For example, our rate typically is around 140 cases per 100,000 a year, so that's about 6,000 to 7,000 cases, and that's 10 times the rate as, say, compared with the United States. So we're still not sure exactly why the big difference.
So what processes do you recommend people go through to ensure that their chicken is safely prepared?
Well, in this instance, our recent comments on this are based on a study we did where we interviewed people outside supermarkets and butcheries and also looked at the product inside that was being available for sale. And basically what people wanted was, firstly, they're not that aware about the level of contamination of the product. They're also not aware of some of the basic steps for protecting themselves. And we felt, and they also want to see this information on labels. They think it's essential that the product is labeled. And when we went in, the students, it was a student project, when they looked at the labeling in the supermarket, they found that often there was no information at all on the product. And if it was there, it didn't cover a lot of important points. And often the font was very small, almost unreadable. So the main point we were making when we put out a release on this problem was that we think this product needs to be labelled because it's causing about half of the Campylobacter infection in New Zealand, maybe more. And so in some ways it's currently the most dangerous product you ever take into your kitchen from a microbiological point of view. Remember, it only takes one bacteria going into your mouth and you may get this, 5 to 6 or 7 days later, you may get this terrible gastroenteritis.
So there's also a link between raw chicken and the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. Recently in New Zealand, it was found that a high proportion of these bacteria carried were resistant to antibiotics. And this actually shocked people because in the past, this bacteria wasn't very resistant. And then it was suddenly found that there were high levels of resistance in across the country and people being seen with Campylobacter infection, and it was traced back to the fact that the chicken now has high levels of resistant bacteria.
At a farming level, how can farmers act to reduce bacteria risks?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, the two main strategies for reducing Campylobacter in the chicken, because that afterwards the best thing we can do, is what's called on-farm security, where they try and stop these flocks of birds getting infected in the first place. And that's actually very difficult to do because this bacteria is part of the normal bowel content of chickens and birds and animals. So it's very hard to stop it getting into these big sheds, because a typical chicken, it only takes 4 to 5 weeks from being laid, or I should say from being a tiny newborn chicken, if you like, newly hatched chicken, to being at a size where it's slaughtered. It's only 4 to 5 weeks. It's a very rapid process, and they're reared in these huge, often in these huge sheds. So it's very hard to stop the campylobacter getting in there, and people are trying all sorts of approaches at that point, but it's very difficult. So the big problem is really how they're slaughtered and processed. And during that process, which is very mechanized, which is one reason it's a very cheap food, is they're mechanically decapitated and plucked and then eviscerated. And during that process, quite often the machines will rupture the bowels of the chickens and spread chicken feces all over the carcass. And it's just been plucked, so the skin is quite rough, and that means that the bacteria get embedded in the skin, and the places where the feathers were removed. It's then put in a spin chiller, which is chlorinated chilled water, and that will kill most of the bacteria, but unfortunately it still leaves usually several thousand campylobacter on every chicken carcass, and that's the problem. And then it's distributed in a chilled form around the country, and chilling actually maintains the bacteria. It doesn't really die off. It doesn't breed, because it only really starts to breed at quite high temperatures, you know, blood temperature, you know, really above 34 degrees or so. And so you then put that in your fridge, and that actually maintains, it's fresh chicken, that maintains the chicken, the bacteria. So you have to be really extremely careful how you handle that, and just assume it's covered in bacteria, which is the case, and treat it accordingly.
Do you think if chickens were hand slaughtered, whether that would reduce the risk at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, historically, our methods of chicken production and distribution were very different. You know, going back 30 years, chickens were sold generally frozen, and they were only eaten on sort of special occasions. And since then, we've switched to a fresh poultry industry. That's the dominance where it's distributed. And that's created, with the rise of fresh chicken production and sale in New Zealand, that's coincided with the huge rise in campylobacter. And that's really the big driver of the epidemic. As you might have gathered, our main suggestion from this, we've done a lot of research on this for several years, our main proposal to the regulators is that there be a safety warning on all fresh chicken sold in New Zealand. We think that's the least that industry should do, given the level of contamination of this product and the amount of illness it causes. And I should say that the numbers are quite disturbing. We estimate that there's around 60,000 cases of campylobacter infection in New Zealand every year. It's put 600 people in hospital, and it caused around 30 cases of paralysis from a thing called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And half of this burden is coming from fresh chicken, maybe more. And so that's why we are creating a fuss about it, because we just think this is really a critical food safety issue that New Zealand should fix, and it could fix.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Yes, that is the end of The Wire. That brings us to the end of another show for another week. Big thanks to all those who spoke with us on the show today, which was Alan Blackman, Tracy Martin, Liv Young, and Michael Baker. Thank you to Lillian Hanley and producers Lisa Baudet and Ben Weber. And of course, thank you to all those who tuned in. That's all from us today. Bridges up next to the one with the 1 to 4. And actually, we're doing a Zeta reset, so you're gonna be listening to some sweet analog vinyls. It's just imagine that when you're listening to the radio, and just enjoy yourself. Goodbye.
That's dumb, Duncan.
The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.